Oh, wow. I could listen to that all day long. That's Eddie Lockjaw Davis on his trusty tenor sax with The Chef. It's from volume one of Davis's acclaimed and masterful cookbook series, recorded in 1958. And of course, I mean, it's a twofer. You get Eddie Lockjaw Davis, but as the ads say, but wait, there's more. He's paired here with Shirley Scott, my very, very favorite lady on jazz organ, the Hammond B3. They ushered in together the soul jazz sound of the 1950s. Jerome Richardson also is on this album on flute, George Duvivier on bass, and Arthur Edgehill on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Wednesday. My gosh, how time flies. May 13th, 2015. And I wanted to pick up from where we left off yesterday. We started talking yesterday about this yielding to the duopoly as we are seeing unfolding before our very eyes. And that is in connection with the 2016 presidential race, the question raised yesterday, and which we began to discuss yesterday, is as the presidential race picks up some steam, and we're beginning to see, how the lay of the land is going to be working on both the Republican and Democratic side, and that's the reference to the duopoly there. Republicans versus Democrats. In the middle of all of this, we really should be asking the question, where is the left or the third party or some other alternative? Are we still stuck with this tired, annoying formula of having to choose between the lesser of two evils and the evil of two lessers? Is this where we are again in 2016? And your thoughts began to unfold yesterday, and I'd like to continue because we had quite a few people who didn't get a chance to talk yesterday. And so it is open to you today, 888-874-4888, to continue the conversation. What we're looking here for, not necessarily answers, because I don't think they're, that we have the answers, but we are looking for analysis of where we stand. What is going on? Why is it that as we stand on the cusp of a major election, and there's so many things already that should cause us great concern about where the candidates, wherever they are on the political spectrum, stand, we should be concerned that we're not hearing very much and we're not seeing very much of a groundswell or even the makings of some kind of an oppositional force to what's going to be presented as our choices come 2016. And this should trouble us. It should trouble us because the polls all along have been telling us for at least 2 years now that the people are fed up. We see clear evidence in terms of the recent demonstrations all across the country having to do with police brutality and use of force, police killings of our fellow citizens. And it's just one dimension, but there are so many other aspects to what we call our daily lives that people are very upset and fed up with. And yet, we're not seeing that it is translating into political organization and activity as if to suggest that there will be any kind of opposition come 2016 with the great presidential race and the other ancillary races attached to that. So where are we? Have we been asleep? Have we fallen asleep? Have we just basically lost interest? Are we, as they say, used to say, shucking and jiving? We talk the talk, but we're not walking the walk. Are we already prepared to just yield to the status quo and say, well, whatever, we'll just go along for the ride, however it turns out? Are we shirking our responsibility? Do we have any sense at all that we make a difference? Or have we lost that too? These are the questions. And in a way, I think the exploration of the question is more desired than an answer, because we don't necessarily have answers at this point. We're just interested in exploring the question. Where are we in the scheme of things? What do we make of our political reality as it stands today? And more so as we look in the immediate future to yet another chapter of political life and the consequences of that political life. I talked yesterday about the Obama administration, certainly coming after the Bush administration. There was so much hope. There was so much anticipation that this vibrant young man from Chicago, imbued with all the things that he said he was imbued with, a sense of a need for change and taking on a system and putting in place something new, advancing a kind of humanitarian agenda. I don't want to use the word progressive because people don't even know what it means anymore. But we saw what a huge investment was made there. It didn't take in the first administration at all. In fact, what we saw was that, as I said yesterday, we saw that the president held to the loyalty to the party more than to the people. We saw an opportunity essentially wasted, or certainly not at all bearing the fruit that people were hoping for. And the hopes of the people were not extraordinary and out of range. You know, they were hoping for what people all over the world hope for: a decent life, the ability to work and have your labor basically yield the kind of money and wages that would help you, you know, support yourself and your family, send your children to schools that actually teach them something and prepare them to be productive people. You want to be living somewhere desirable. You don't want to live in a community that has been written off for decades. You want certainly to feel safe and secure, that the people who are hired with your tax dollars to protect you and to safeguard your person and your property and so forth, that that's what they will do and not, you know, just dispatch you from the earth. Basic things. You want to be able to have access to decent medical care. You want basic things. And for the full term of President Obama's first 4 years, we saw this cleavage become more rigid, more clear, to the point where people are now politely talking about, you know, income inequality. It's a nice, neat phrase. They don't want to say that there are two Americas right now, the rich and the rest, but that's it, the rich and the rest. So these are the realities that we are living with and in. And we say we are opposed to it. We say that there ought to be a better way. We denounce the continuation of this mindset in the way policies are made and the way that our lives are impacted by these anti-human policies. We say all these things, but here we are. We are at the cusp of a major political event, that will determine much of our future, certainly our immediate future. And yet we are not hearing this supposedly large constituency of people who supposedly are so disaffected, so angry, so turned off. So what is going on? What is going on? Are we just talking? And at the same time, prepared to settle, prepared to yield to the duopoly. We will still go along to get along. We'll still play the game. We'll still cast our votes. We'll show up like lemmings and pull a lever and say, well, you know, I'm not expecting much, but this is what I'm going to do. And we just slink off into the shadows and bear with whatever comes for the next 4 years. So I'm asking us essentially to face ourselves. Where are we? What is happening? Why is it that we are not seeing a more enthusiastic approach to independent action? People saying, well, okay, we've gone through now 8 years of something that just did not take. And we have the power and ability to put an end to some of this. We have the power and the ability and the leverage to at least turn something our way. We have the power and ability to flex our muscles here. But what is the vehicle? What is the vehicle that is going to exercise your leverage? How are you going to influence change? So, in a sense, it's a kind of act of contrition. Have we really just been talking, or have we also been walking? This is where the rubber meets the road, and I think we have to face ourselves. We have to face the contradiction that we're prepared to talk about things. We're prepared to criticize. We're prepared to point fingers and exact blame. We're prepared to sound off. But of course, this is work. The work of transformation. And it is literally at the cellular or micro level. It is right where you live. It starts there. But I don't want to deal with blame today. I want to talk about what is it that we are dealing with? What is the situation? What is the reality? So that somehow, by doing so, we can kind of come to a new assessment that there is still time to do something. There is still time to self-correct. There's still time to organize differently and achieve some kind of a goal, some kind of a benefit. But we first have to figure out exactly where are we? What have we been doing? Why are we not in a position today, even as more and more of these candidates emerge from the shadows and present themselves as our next leaders or would-be leaders? We seem to have no response. I mean, no response that counts. So that's where I wanted to go today. We continue the discussion on that level. We're not looking necessarily for answers. We'll get to that somewhere down the line, but as we define the problems. But first, let's decide exactly what it is. What's the state of affairs with us? Where are we? What are we doing? What is our position with respect to the awesomeness that confronts us? How are we situated? How did we get here? That's the political work today. 888-874-4888. And as I wait for your calls, I just wanted to let you know that, again, Gary gave an update on my situation. I feel I'm not depressed at all. I must tell you that. And I really need you to believe that. I'm not depressed. It is what it is, and we're dealing with it. Straight on. That's the only way I go. So whatever it is that I have to deal with, I'm going to deal with it. And I must say again, and I will continue to say it as often as I possibly can, how blessed and fortunate and just incredibly supported I am with your good thoughts and your good words and your help and support. It's remarkable. I have no idea what I did to deserve it, but I am so glad to be on the receiving end of it. And so I thank you. I really, really thank you for extending to me the best part of yourselves. So this is why I consider this a very special family and why we should be talking to each other honestly and openly without fear that, you know, injuring anybody. We're not. We're just talking what we feel. And that's as genuine as you can go. And that's what radio really should do, to bring together people in an atmosphere and an environment where you can talk freely. I mean, of course, we're not injuring anybody. We have to have some kind of place to talk. And this is what I think this program should do. And I hope I'm doing my job. Okay, so that's that. But it's now about talking about this political quagmire we seem to be in. And let's take the calls. From New York, Joel. Hello, Joel. You're on the air.
Hi, Idris.
Hi.
Good to talk to you again. Nice to hear your voice and good to talk to you.
Thank you. Same dear.
You know, I think I just sent you a post about Hillary Clinton, and I really don't want to talk about
it. Yes, I saw it this morning. She's back.
Yep. But I really don't want to talk about her, even though she's symptomatic of the political pathologies that are in front of us. I think what you're really driving at is why have we been so inert? And what is it that that must be done so that we can extract ourselves from this miasma that we're in, and you know, recognize the crises that are in front of us, and then act accordingly. And it seems to me that the first thing that we have to do is to recognize that there is a mass number of aggrieved people around the country. And that they have to be identified as such. We're talking about multiple millions of people who are disenfranchised, whose civil liberties have been extracted from them, whose job prospects are limited or nil. And they comprise a variety of groups. For instance, many of our cities across the country, especially in what are called the inner cities, we have large numbers of people of color who used to constitute what Marx called the proletarian class. By that I mean people who are exploited, by businesses, who own no property but who work for an exploitative wage. Now they've been joined. Of course, they've always been there, but the numbers are much larger, by a class that Marx called the lumpen proletariat, what we call the underclass. These are people who are not only propertyless, but have no work whatsoever, and their prospects for work are limited or nil. Our leading political essayist, Chris Hedges, has called these places sacrifice zones. And in the past, the way capitalist economics worked was that a large group of surplus labor was always available to provide employment for capitalist industry. And in that way, they would be able to keep wages down. But now we have a new phenomenon across the world, and I think the globalized economic character of the world sort of exemplifies this, and that is that productive capital has been replaced by financial capital. Money is now created out of thin air. It is not so important how much is produced and even how much is consumed. The idea is to exploit the speculative markets and make a lot of money for people who have money. And that means that labor becomes superfluous. And that's one of the reasons why war has been waged against them. But we are now waging war against the poorest of the poor. Anybody who looks at the situation around the world and then looks at what is happening in our cities sees that they replicate each other. I mean, Yemen, Somalia, Afghanistan, these are the poorest lands in the world that we are destroying. And now we are doing it in our communities as well. So what must be done? The first thing that has to be done is that we have to recognize that we can't do this through identity politics. I keep saying this on your program, and I know I'm being redundant, but really we're talking about reality. And ideals must somehow be able to somehow realize themselves in the world, or else they become nothing more than abstractions. So we have to recognize that there are large groups of people in cities who need to be mobilized, but it's not just them. It's not just black young males in cities who need to be and who are being mobilized now in groups around the country, because they recognize that they're in a revolutionary situation. But they have to join with the others. They have to join with the millions of people who have been displaced. They have to join with the hundreds of, really the thousands, I should say, of young college teachers, adjunct college. They represent the majority of people teaching in colleges right now who are working at a massively exploitive wage. These people are proletarianized already. They are ready to be mobilized.
I see where you're going, and I agree with your analysis. I mean, two things. One, what about the maxim that the basis of your oppression is also the basis for your organizing, number one. And number two, this leaving out, the excising of these constituencies that are oppressed, to what degree do the so-called progressive and third party and even radical movements have basically decided that they too can avoid them, and they too can ignore them?
Well, you know, hypocrisy is a major feature of American life. When you was, you know, talking about this now, I was thinking of Tom Hayden. We might as well name names. And I was out in California when, back in the, I guess it was the late 70s, when he decided to run for the state legislature. By that time, he was hooked up with Jane Fonda, so he'd become even more of a national figure than he was when he was, you know, that the SDS firebrand in 1968. And he proceeded to accommodate himself to political reality. Santa Monica has a large middle-class Jewish constituency, and he supported the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1980. Tom Hayden, here is a man who is the archetype of what the left was supposed to be all about. So, you know, I'm under no illusions that there are individuals on the left who place their own personal ambition over ideological and just necessity. So that, but there are plenty of people who aren't like that, and there are plenty of people who recognize that what we need is a united front of all who have been disenfranchised and who have been extracted from the labor force and who are being shat upon, spat upon, and spat up and sat on. And, you know, we're talking about the majority of the country, Utrecht. We're talking about elders. We're talking about young students in colleges. I mean, we have a $1.3 trillion university and graduate school debt that will never be repaid. These people are an explosive force who are ready to be organized. Around the country, there are many, many student organizations that are now involved in debt jubilee politics, who are refusing to pay their debts. An explosion is coming. It is coming. There's no question that it is coming. I've never seen anything like this in my lifetime. The important thing that we have to do is to recognize that the explosion will be inchoate unless we get a handle on it and begin to take the necessary steps of organizing all groups to create a united front to confront those who are in power. And it's not going to work by supporting someone like Bernie Sanders, who is really nothing more than a front man for Hillary Clinton. He's going to support her in the end, you know, and he supported all of these military appropriations. So is Elizabeth Warren. I mean, they take the right stands on economic populism, of course, but you can't call yourself an egalitarian and support, you know, this Hitlerian foreign policy, this militarized foreign policy. You know what I mean? And the other thing that we have to do is we have to, and then I want to get off because others want to talk. The only other thing I want to say is that we are about to confront the politics of really unwanted consequences. And a lot of it is going to have to do with the climate. We're going to see millions of people migrating. And, you know, the wealthy already are beginning to take their steps. The wealthy in California are already beginning to buy land in places like British Columbia and places like that where there is water. But for the rest of us and for many people who live in the inner cities and who are marginalized, those who live in the sacrifice zones, it's not going to be. So we have to organize around these issues because these are issues that we have never faced before. And if we don't organize, the wealthy will take all of the resources, all of the water, and we will be left in a kind of Mad Max situation. So really, out of necessity, we have to do this. We have to take our inchoate anger and turn it into a coherent response.
Thank you so much. Extraordinary.
Okay, you're welcome.
Insights
Bye-bye.
Today. Thank you, Joel, for your call. From Queens, Boris, you're on the air.
Hello. How are you doing, Latrice?
Fine. Thank you, Boris. What are your thoughts?
I would like to encourage you to continue with your regimen that Gary Noel has suggested to you and recommended for you. And,
thank you.
My heart goes out to you.
Thank you.
We are in a political climate. There are certain elements that are not being addressed. And there are certain topics and components that have not been placed on the table. And a good author by the name of Naomi Klein has coined it externalities. And the left, the so-called left, or the true left, and the progressive movement have been victimized and reduced to externalities. On all different facets, on all different ethnic backgrounds, meaning that we try and hope for the best, leverage for particular candidates of the particular day, Ralph Nader, vis-a-vis those that are running on the independent road, and we fall blindside to our results, to our agenda, to our needs. Why? Because there are, as you've said, two political groups that are both reaching for the same goal and both have common interests, and that is the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. And because of their deregulations of various safeguards and mechanisms that were put in place basically hundreds of years ago, 70 years ago, 860 years ago, the Bar Association, the FCC, the Federal Communications deregulations, Wall Street deregulations with the Taft-Hartley and commercial banks now are merging with private banks. We've become the middle class, the working class, and even those who are poor, of course the poor, have been victimized of this externality, where right now, because of this result, we are socially engineered to be splinter groups. Lack of a better word, scraping, crawling to the top of the food, top of the ladder, to get our voices heard. We're scraping and crawling and fighting amongst each other in not a physical matter, but in a more of a sense of me, and whoever shouts the loudest will get the most attention. it's come to the point where it has to be a dynamic reinventing of the progressive movement on the national, even international level.
Where I want to ask you, Boris, because I mean, I see where you're going here, but do you believe, from what you have observed and experienced, do you believe that in many ways, this contract that used to be held out, people used to say, well, we are here for you. This party is here for you. And we have a way of, if you join us, we will be able to fight together. Do you get a sense that there's a retreat from these communities rather than an accelerated involvement and coming to these communities to win them, to woo them, to make known, to educate them as to why it is important to come together on things that they commonly share?
There are a few replies and responses I can answer to that. One is that there is a sense of retreat, meaning that we're not invited to the media levels, to the high media levels, to hear our talk. We are subjugated or are left to our own devices to having these outlets of the West Coast having their outlets and gatherings and gathering halls and webinars and talk radio shows to vent the frustrations of the people. We are regulated to those splinter groups and fractions on the East Coast to talk shows and different symposiums and events, and that's it. The higher echelons, the Al Sharptons of the world, the Jesse Jackson of the world, the Ralph Naders of the world, even Gary Noel and the Christopher Hedges of the world and our leaders have not groomed, they have not prepared an heir apparent. There is no heir apparent that I can see, and I've discussed this personally with the very people I just mentioned. Who is your heir apparent? Who is the person that you will see the next generation of the millennium generation, of even Generation X?
But here's a question now, Boris. Whose job is it? I mean, in the end, if you recognize that you are an oppressed person, let's just say, you are suffering inordinately because of the structure of society that we live in and so forth. Is it not really your job to at least become the prime actor in your own fate? Or do you simply just look around and say, well, you ought to be carrying my water? I mean, at what point does it become the responsibility of the aggrieved people, of the oppressed people themselves, to fashion a response to their oppression? Why must we always look and say, well, that person is not doing the job, and it's not, and he or she is not doing the job because I have not been able to unburden everything and give them the responsibility of fixing the problem? In the end, is it not also the responsibility, the prime responsibility of individuals not to look to others necessarily for leadership, because leadership it starts with the individual, isn't it?
I would have to disagree with the context and the positioning of the question because it lends itself to believe that there is no younger generation leadership. There is no individual effort of a younger generation, 45 years old and younger, to take the mantle and to lead. I beg to differ. They are out there. They are willing to fight. There are community organizers. I've seen them all over the nation, they've been, Latrice, I beg to differ. They have been bottlenecked by this privileged, progressive class of those in the higher echelons who do not want them to be heard. It goes back to the Ralph Naders, the Gary Knowles, the Reverend Al Sharptons, and to Jim Hightower, to the media outlets, Tom Hartman. The progressive left have done themselves a disservice by not allowing or anointing younger voices to be on the higher platforms of the media stage, so that they can take on the mantle of the movement. They can take on the potential to be a major candidate in these political movements. Right now, no, I would have to say that Christopher Hedges have coined it. The opposition have turned themselves from the Republican Party to neoliberals to homo economics. They're homo economicus. And these
I'm interested, you know, for me, yeah. I mean, personally, I understand that from what you're saying, you have fixed this thing as a personality-driven system. And I wonder whether you feel comfortable with the fact that you know for sure that there has been no grooming going on. And number two, it still does not address the question I asked you. When you give that much power yourself, when you give that
I do
power
not. Yeah.
to an individual.
Your question is valid. However, it comes from the point that there is a presumption that there is no younger leadership.
No. I don't say that at all. In fact, I know quite differently. In fact, during this whole thing with from Ferguson, I was real clear that the leadership was coming from the young people. They are the ones who put this entire nation on notice. There's no question about that. And in fact, I said, these are the people who are the leaders, and they need to be supported. They need to be surrounded by people who know that sometimes you lead by following. So it is. I'm very clear about the role of younger people, and I don't see that, you know, there's a paucity of young people wanting to lead. But I also don't like the idea of looking at the situation in terms of leadership and followership, because my point is everybody is supposed to be the leader they're looking for. So if you could, from your observation, from your own experience, what do you believe is at issue? You've done a good job of laying out the landscape to a great degree, but what is it that brings us to this point where the leadership, having expressed itself in many ways, we saw it in Baltimore, we saw it in Wisconsin, we saw it in Ferguson, Missouri, saw it in Staten Island, New York. What is it that is not gelling? What's not happening here? The leadership is there. It's expressed itself. It has shown its ability to mobilize people. What is preventing the jump now from mobilizing to organizing?
I think that the biggest disconnect, if you could call it a disconnect, is the lack of will from those who are have the media and the political and the popular cachet to bring those younger leaders to the table. And that's not happening. I'm criticizing everyone. I'm criticizing those who are from
I get you.
I'm criticizing those who are from those who I respect dearly and love. From Gary Noel, who I respect dearly enough. Where is Gary Noel's predecessor? I mean, I'm sorry, where is Gary Noh's leader? He is a great man with great leadership. He's been censored on so many different media programs. He's not going to last forever for another 50 years. Where is his heir apparent to come in? And I keep saying that.
Well, I can tell you, I happen to know the answer to this particular question. Sometimes people do things outside of the warm glow of the television cameras and the microphones. Sometimes the work they do is not seen. It is not out there for, you know, accolades and for acclamation. Sometimes it's very quiet work. I happen to do very quiet work with a bunch of people in the business of producing or helping to continue historical records. You don't mm-hmm. know any of the people. If I were to tell you their names, you wouldn't know them because they're not
that.
Into public acclamation. They just get up every day and they put their nose to the grindstone and they do the work very quietly. And in this regard, I just want to say this is really important.
Yes.
Because we have a lot of show. There's a lot of showmanship going on that's passing for leadership. But I happen to know many people in many spheres of life who are very quietly doing the hard, gritty, unsexy, unrewarding, annoying, frustrating, angering work. And they do that mm-hmm. without complaint, and they do it steadily, and they've been doing that for years. I know that to be the case with Gary. I know that to be the case with many other people who, in fact, this is the conversation we have very often. It's about people showing up and giving the impression that they are actually leading when, in fact, you know, they're doing nothing of the sort. In the field of the law, I've said it on this program. There's nobody I know more formidable a force in a courtroom than Alton Maddox. And when I was reporting, when I called Alton Maddox and I couldn't get him on the phone, I knew exactly where to find him. He was in a law library. I knew exactly where to go. So the
may
thing
I mention
is
something
that,
about Alton, you know, Maddox? I'd like to make a comment about Mr. Maddox.
But I don't want to get into the personality thing. I'm trying to
It's not a personality thing. You're absolutely right. It's a way of the behind the scenes work is appreciated and is commendable and should be done. It's not a personality issue.
The behind the scenes work is leadership. In my own field.
Right. But there's a big problem with leadership who are 55, 60-year-old, 70-year-old individuals continuing to have generation upon generations of people move to the side or bottlenecked and are terrified or intimidated by having these voices heard on the table. I see it even in the phone screening of calling on your show. There seem to be a terrified or screening process where they don't want to hear different voices. I've had this with media channels, but hear me out, because I don't want anyone to be in defensive. It's not a defensive mode. It's a simple analysis of how we're going to move forward.
I want to have this exchange. It has never, ever, ever been my practice on my program and in any form of journalism that I screen people and or have them screened. Never. I never screen guests. Anybody who has appeared on this program will tell you. I never tell them. I never ask them what they want to talk about. I never tell them what we're going to talk about. I assume that if you are an expert in a particular field, then let's start the conversation. And that's it. I never, in 40-odd years of doing this, I've never done that. I understand your point.
Okay.
I understand the generational issue. I understand where you're going, and I think it's very valid, the concern about the cultivation of leadership. But it is slightly different from the focus of what it is we wanted to talk about today, although very much relevant, which is, where are we? And why is it that we are not seeing the kind of movement building? And you've pointed out some really good reasons. I really think many of them are very valid. However, I think, too, you have to also, you know, give a grain of salt here, that sometimes the situation is far more complex than we can appreciate. In my own field, I'll just talk about me. I've been asking for years, who's training the next generation of journalists? I mean, I did. I trained quite a few, hundreds, for free. And it was important to me to do that because I knew that at some point we will have to rely on our own folks who are organically linked to these communities to report on them, and they will do a much better job. So in every sphere of endeavor, the leadership still starts with the individual. It still starts with the individual. You've got to be accountable. How do we stand? And let me ask you now, having a pretty clear lay of the land, where do you see yourself fitting in all of this mobilizing and cultivating a sense of leadership? Where do you fit?
I'm still here. Hello?
Yeah. Where do you fit?
Okay. I see myself as an inspirational individual and perhaps in a leadership capacity, but that's been subordinated by the more important aspect of sharing my knowledge with different people, different walks of life, encouraging them to step out of their comfort zone and share the knowledge that we have cultivated with like minds and those who are not like minds at the mm-hmm. water cooler, at the 9-to-5 job, at their cousin, which is difficult. And I can talk about that as a whole different subject, but also share my knowledge, share my experience with those who are not of like mind and encourage them to step out their comfort zone because they are frustrated too. They're not part of the 1%. Go to your particular ethnic background family and convince them that something is completely wrong, that this economy, the political atmosphere is on life support. Your jobs have been, jobs for the past 30 years since Ronald Reagan have been shipped overseas, but yet you want to blame the black man or the Latino man from stealing your jobs or from robbing somebody or jumping the turnstile. That's not going to be the fix. That's not the fix. That's just a perpetual, socially, politically engineered, deliberately engineered schism that's causing this country to go downhill.
Are you hopeful that let's say for 2016, are you hopeful that you'd see signs of a groundswell of activism?
If I see my favorite or our collective favorite media outlets give truth to power and bring up these voices that have not been heard from those, now hear me out, from those who are Black Lives Matter movement to Code Pink, Medea Benjamin. If I hear these our favorite and our reliable media outlets, Tom Hartman, yours, Gary Noel, InfoWords, wherever they may be, allow these particular voices to be heard rather than bottlenecking them, the Medea Benjamins of the world, the Black Lives Matter of the world, those who have particular interest in the women's movement. I don't hear these voices all the time. It seems to be there's an ego war going on where
people are intimidated of hearing new voices. And they're not really new. They've been on the scene for 30, 20 years. When I have never seen, well, I can't say never, I have rarely seen this powerhouse woman, and she's one of dozens, who goes on the House congressional floor and she wrecks shop. And her name is Medea Benjamin. And she's someone who's a small woman of cold pink, and she's one of maybe a two dozen people who you don't even hear them coming on. Where's the producers from these TV shows? Where are these producers from the radio shows to invite these people on? I'm tired of seeing and hearing about correction officers who have a president role in the union coming on the show to defend their job as correction officer for this prison industrial complex to validate their role. I'm tired of hearing about black men talking to black women who are coming from the police department who don't do nothing about police violence. I'm tired of it. I'm tired of having economic experts and colleagues and scholars who've been on the forefront for a long time, but don't do anything else but write books and promote their books. That's what I'm saying. That's what's causing the subordination of a new movement coming up. 60 years old, 50 years old, and 40 or younger.
Thank you so much. You said quite a lot today and much to think about, but it was your truth. And it is, in fact, something that we should be paying attention to because it's a valid issue. You know, the grooming of the next generation of leaders. Thank you so much for your call.
Thank you. You're welcome. I would say Altimatics is correct. You do bring out the best in people and keep up the good work. And God bless you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for that. Well,
love,
that brings us
care.
To the end of our program today. Two extraordinary exchanges, but dealing with the same question from entirely different perspectives and very valid points made. And this is where we ought to go. We have to start talking about these things because if we don't appreciate, you know, the underside, we will just fall for the cosmetic, you know, thing. Oh, well, there you go. It's a protest movement. So things must be in good shape. We, you know, people are active. And really what I'm saying is I get the sense, now I could be wrong, but I get the sense that we are not yet focused on the business of organizing. Kwame Ture talked about the difference between mobilizing and organizing. You mobilize, which is great. That's great political activity. Then you organize those people you have mobilized because that is where you begin to form political power, which, of course, will lead to your political leverage. And we need to reconstruct this whole idea about what politics is. Politics is very local. Politics is at the cellular and micro level. And it's great when we see these demonstrations, but they should also be reflective of what's going on your block, in your home, in your community. What's the level of consciousness raising going on there? And I'm hoping that with some time, we have a little bit of time left, for 2016, because this presidential election is going to be far more important than we think, because it's going to have ramifications for at least another two, maybe three decades. And so we can't allow the opportunity to slip us by. Thank you so much for joining me today. I hope this was instructive. I want to thank Joel. I want to thank Boris for allowing us the opportunity to examine their thoughts, which they freely shared. It's great, great, great stuff. Stay tuned. Coming up next is NDC Savings Club. You can reach me at leidstories@gmail.com. And I'm trying to get, I'm trying to keep pace with the Facebook page, Lead Stories with Utrice Lee. But in any event, we'll see each other tomorrow, same time. A pleasure, and believe me, a great, great privilege to be in your esteemed company. Bye-bye.
Thank you.